Chapter 9. Medication First. There are two main ways to require long-term psychiatric care in California: conservatorship and assisted outpatient treatment. Under conservatorship, which is called guardianship in other states, a judge appoints a relative or other qualified person to make financial, legal, and other key decisions on behalf of a person deemed gravely disabled by a qualified physician. But California courts have been reluctant to apply conservatorships. And so in 2002, the California legislature passed Lara's Law, named after a college student who was killed by a mentally ill man who had refused psychiatric treatment, to allow for assisted outpatient treatment. Under assisted outpatient treatment, courts can require mentally ill people who do not comply with their treatment plans to be held for up to 72 hours to determine if they meet the standard for involuntary hospitalization. There is good evidence from California and other states that assisted outpatient treatment reduces homelessness and incarceration. 9 of the 10 assisted outpatient treatment programs studied in California reduced criminal justice involvement. 6 out of 7 programs significantly reduced homelessness. Research finds that similar assisted outpatient treatment laws in other states reduced homelessness by up to 74% and arrests of the mentally ill by up to 83%. And yet progressive elected officials and civil liberties leaders use strong language to oppose expanded use of either conservatorship or assisted outpatient treatment. Conservatorship is the biggest deprivation of civil rights aside from the death penalty, said Susan Meisner, an attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union. We're still coming to grips with the forced sterilizations that went on in our hospital, said Los Angeles County Supervisor Sheila Kuhl. My community, young people in my community, were regularly put away in institutions because being gay was a mental illness. This is different, of course, and the families who say this is different, I respect them and I understand. But I always worry, as the line goes in The King and I, might they not protect me out of everything I own? Opposition to involuntary hospitalization is also behind the failure of California's Mental Health Services Act, Proposition 63, passed in 2004. None of the $2.4 billion raised through Proposition 63's tax on millionaires can be used for involuntary treatment. 20% of MHSA money is allocated by the state to spend to prevent mental illness from becoming severe and disabling. But much of this money has been spent on ostensibly therapeutic activities for people with milder mental illness, including exercise classes, gardening, and creative learning circles, rather than on preventative psychiatric treatment of the seriously mentally ill. In 2015, the Little Hoover Commission, an independent oversight body, reported that the state still cannot definitively quantify who has been helped by Proposition 63 spending and how. The result is that the most difficult mentally ill and addicted homeless people end up becoming the responsibility of the police and criminal justice system, where 4 to 5.5 out of every 10,000 people are under conservatorship in neighboring counties, fewer than one person per 10,000 San Francisco residents is. The number of people in San Francisco referred to conservatorships actually declined by 143 between 2012 and 2018. In 2019, San Francisco's Board of Supervisors debated legislation to expand conservatorship to people suffering mental illness and drug addiction. The current law permits California counties to do so only if someone is a chronic user of alcohol or has a serious mental health crisis. The legislation would have changed the law to include people who use drugs or have been 5150'd and taken to psychiatric emergency services 8 times in 1 year. There are about 100 to 150 people who are clearly mentally ill and who are cycling through the system and who need to be forced into conservatorship, said Mayor Breed. We know all of them. She noted that 12% of people who use services provided by the San Francisco Department of Public Health account for 3/4 of the costs. The ACLU and progressives on the board fought the measure. San Francisco Supervisor Matt Haney, who represents the Tenderloin, opposed the measure because 5150s involve law enforcement. A big focus we've been moving toward is to alleviate negative interactions with law enforcement in the community. Lots of people came out to oppose it. It was a huge ideological fight, said Raphael Mandelman in 2020. As a result, the final legislation was extremely weak. The passive form is very hard to implement. It has still not been implemented even in one case in San Francisco. Opposition by the ACLU and progressives is also behind California's failure to apply for and receive federal funding to pay for more psychiatric beds. An obscure provision, the Institutions for Mental Disease, IMD, exclusion, prohibits Medicaid from reimbursing states for adults with mental illness who receive long-term care in a psychiatric hospital with more than 16 beds. The provision requires states to pay 100% of the cost of care for the seriously ill who need long-term hospital care, as compared to 50% for those treated in the community. There's a provision that says Medicaid will now pay for beds in psychiatric hospitals, explained Snook. Medicaid, Title 19 of the Social Security Act, is a federal health care program for the poor that reimburses states for about 50% of the cost of care for people enrolled in it. It is an important source of revenue for useful outpatient programs and provides $30 billion to help the mentally ill. It's a no-brainer, but California is hemming and hawing. They don't want to involuntarily hospitalize, but it's self-defeating because you end up with mentally ill people in jail because a bed isn't available. Snook said that applying for the waiver was somewhat complicated, but at bottom, the failure of California to do so had more to do with ideology than paperwork. There are legitimate pieces that have to be figured out, said Snook. But there's this bullshit stuff of there's no such thing as mental illness. Can you imagine hospitalizing people? And jails are better than hospitals. Psychiatrists say that's absurd. I have been in both places and can assure you that the fate of psychiatric patients in prison dungeons is much worse than was their plight in snake pit hospitals, wrote a psychiatrist in response to such claims. I have seen cell after cell smeared with excrement and mentally ill prisoners shouting their lungs out or drugged into stupor. And our patients are especially vulnerable to physical and sexual abuse. They are disproportionately represented as victims of the 200,000 rapes that occur in prisons each year. Lack of legal tools to impose involuntary care has made some parents of the seriously mentally ill desperate enough to support the arrest of their children. The officers said, "Do you want to press charges?" And I said, "Absolutely," said one mother. "It's the only way. If they're not willing to go for help, there's nothing you can do." But since San Francisco, Los Angeles, and other progressive cities have largely stopped enforcing the laws against public defecation and open-air drug use, the police do not make those arrests and often do not investigate violations of the law by potentially mentally ill homeless people, as I discovered after calling the police on more than 6 separate occasions in between late 2020 and early 2021 to report people who are psychotic and a potential danger to themselves and others. In one instance, a half-naked man crashed into the glass windows at the front of our retail offices in Berkeley, collapsing outside the Italian restaurant next door. In another, a highly intoxicated man wandered into traffic wearing dark clothes and was nearly hit by a car. L.A. street doctor Susan Bartovi contrasts our society's treatment of psychosis to our treatment of dementia. "My mom has dementia now," she said. serious Alzheimer's. She would have been homeless had I not been around. We don't have a problem telling our demented family members, you need to go to home care and take this medicine. And eventually they do. Why is that different than a psychiatric illness? Today, the problem facing the mentally ill homeless in California is the exact opposite to the one Foucault worried about, concluded UCLA sociologist Neil Gong. The way social workers on Skid Row in Los Angeles care for the homeless mentally ill does not aim at the deep internalizations of norms, as in a Foucauldian model, wrote Gong. It is driven primarily by the dynamics of legal liability, as workers must both try to prevent danger and avoid violating patient rights. Therapy is oriented toward very modest goals, like trying to get a woman to stop banging her head against the wall, according to Gong. As such, the criminalization rather than hospitalization of the mentally ill represents a triumph of the anti-psychiatrists. Recall that U.S. thinkers like Zaz, writes Gong, advocated a radical libertarianism that saw criminal trial as fairer than hospitalization, and in some sense the American criminalization and social abandonment of mad people resembles this model. In his memoir, former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown writes, I discovered factors, some bureaucratic, some political, working in a kind of evil synthesis with each other that really prevented the long-term homeless from entering the system. Backing this up was a collection of so-called activists with heavy political clout who absolutely believed and still believe that homeless people should have a right to live on the street. They believed that homeless people had an absolute right to do everything they were doing, no matter how harmful to themselves or to the rest of the citizenry. Susan agrees. California is really one of the worst states when it comes to taking care of seriously mentally ill, she said. I think a lot has to do with civil liberties. It's really ingrained in the culture. At a shelter in Amsterdam during my second trip in the fall of 2019, I watched René Jaegerius argue with an intelligent man with severe Asperger's who was refusing to attend a work placement opportunity that was waiting for him, and with a mentally ill woman whose daughter had been taken from her custody by the government. He told them both they would get better housing if they followed their plans. After René offered the woman an apartment of her own if she took her medication, she stormed out in a rage. She sat in the courtyard of the shelter and smoked a joint. I watched the expressions of René and the two other social workers. They seemed strangely calm. That's okay to let her smoke marijuana like that? I asked. Everyone kind of shrugged. René said that marijuana was better than other drugs, including alcohol. Could you offer to reunite her with her daughter? I asked. If she took her meds? That would have been the next thing I would have offered, he said. By offering better housing in exchange for behavior change, René was practicing contingency management, which, studies over the last three decades find, results in the largest and most long-lasting reductions in alcohol and drug use of all kinds of treatment, and works well for people with serious mental illness. In a major recent review of the literature, out of 176 controlled studies, 151 of them, or 86%, found contingency management to be effective for treating addiction, with the average effect size ranging from moderate to large. On average, a small but significant effect remained even after incentives were discontinued. It significantly increased participation in therapy, a key component of addiction recovery. Contingency management can also reduce psychiatric hospitalizations, improve financial management, and raise the quality of life for the mentally ill suffering substance abuse disorder. A large randomized controlled trial among the seriously mentally ill, two-thirds of whom were homeless, found that the participants who received the contingency management intervention were 2.4 times more likely to be abstinent than the control group. Contingency management had a very low cost compared to other forms of drug treatment, just over $100 per week per participant. Those receiving contingency management were one-fifth as likely to be hospitalized for psychiatric reasons. And abstinence persisted after treatment was discontinued, researchers found, which has been replicated by many subsequent studies. Contingency management harnesses well-established psychological principles, which is likely why it works for such a wide number of people and such a large spectrum of drugs, including both opioids and stimulants. Contingency management is based on the psychological theory of operant conditioning. It emphasizes the need for concrete and immediate reinforcements, such as housing or a gift card, in exchange for good behavior, including abstinence, work, and compliance with psychiatric medicines. Contingency management swaps one set of rewards, such as meth and heroin, for another set of rewards, such as gift cards and apartment units. Operant conditioning was called behaviorism in the 60s and 70s. It gained a bad reputation when some people took it too far and viewed humans purely as animals driven by instinct. But since then, psychologists have demonstrated that humans are significantly motivated by tangible real-world rewards, and that operant conditioning can be used humanely. Despite the evidence in favor of contingency management, it remains rarely used in the United States. Part of the reason is that it has been unpopular with some policymakers and practitioners who are skeptical that it makes a difference over the long term. But contingency management has been included in the National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs and Practices, adopted and implemented by the Department of Veterans Affairs, as well as by the governments and medical establishments of the United Kingdom, Brazil, and China. Hundreds of studies, meta-analyses, and reviews published in the world's leading scientific journals conclude that contingency management works as well as, and often better than, any other drug treatment. One concern is that people need internal motivation to stay abstinent and cannot depend on external reinforcements because once the external reinforcements are gone, their self-destructive behaviors will return. But there is evidence that external reinforcements build internal strength over time. And even if contingency management only kept people externally motivated, that might be okay, given the high cost to society of addiction and the cost savings from abstinence. Assertive case management is critical to keeping the mentally ill out of jails and prisons, said Renee. He told me about helping a man with schizophrenia. His mother came to me 25 years ago when he was 25, said Renee. He was on the streets. He didn't have contact with anyone. He didn't want to go to a shelter. I got in contact with him. We connected. Renee paused. Sometimes you do something that you're not supposed to do, but that you have to do. I did not do anything wrong, but two times I grabbed him and said, "If you do not listen, you get in trouble with me." I don't know what kind of trouble, but that's just something that I said. So I went with him to a shelter with a lot of different sort of patients, and with a room for himself. We made sure that he blended in with all the other crazy people. He stayed there for a few weeks, and then I wanted to take him the next step, which would be medication. He didn't want to take it, so with the police, I admitted him against his will to the psychiatric hospital. I did that twice. Later on, I had the opportunity to get him to the next level of sheltering, etc., etc. Now he's living on his own with a car and a job. He calls me every Friday to say how he did that week. He uses Lepinex, clozapine, which is a lot. He's still psychotic, but he can discuss it with me. One time he said, "I think there are people in my garden watching me." I said, "Please close the curtains." He does so and then says, "Okay, it worked." In early 2020, I asked two ACLU representatives about their organization's position toward involuntary psychiatric treatment as an alternative to incarceration for the mentally ill who break the law. We support the Housing First model, not involuntary treatment, said ACLU attorney Jamie Crook, which has proven to be ineffective and has violated liberties without keeping people off the streets, said her colleague Eve Garrow. All of the research to date shows that coercive or involuntary outpatient treatment is no more effective and sometimes less effective than voluntary treatment. We're very much against it. But comparing voluntary to involuntary treatment isn't an apples-to-apples comparison. Two different groups of people are being compared, those who admit they have a problem and those who do not. Everybody would prefer 100% voluntary treatment, but the fact that involuntary treatment may be less effective than voluntary treatment is not an argument against it, since it might be a better alternative than incarceration, homelessness, or crime. Do you think people are living in tents on Skid Row because they are too poor to afford an apartment? I asked. The root cause, said Garrow, no matter how a person falls into homelessness, the root cause is always the scarcity of affordable housing. I asked the ACLU's lead attorney on the issue, Susan Meisner, why the ACLU opposed conservatorship for people suffering psychosis, but not for people with dementia. What's the difference? Is it because one is about aging and the other about mental illness? The biggest difference, she said, is that dementia tends to be more constant and deteriorating, whereas psychiatric disabilities are more episodic and responsive to treatment. I think a fair number of psychiatrists would say that untreated psychosis is degenerative, I said. I said responsive to treatment, she said. So, because it's responsive to treatment, less coercion is merited? Because it's responsive to treatment, and because coercion in treatment hasn't been shown to be more effective. So, let's say somebody defecates 10 times on the sidewalk, is finally arrested and brought to the courts. Would you favor a situation where that person would have the option of getting psychiatric care as an alternative to prison or jail? I would favor the option of them not being arrested in the first place. That whole scenario is problematic. So what do we do about people with psychosis who defecate in public, who shoot drugs in public? Should they be treated any differently than somebody who is not showing signs of mental illness? We should be using more models like full-service partnerships where we have persistent and patient outreach that develops relationships with the individuals and meets them where they are, so that the trust develops and then moves them into housing and treatment, she said. A case manager or a social worker needs to build rapport with someone to overcome that individual experience and the psychosis. So which laws specifically should we not enforce? I asked. Because what you said is that we should not enforce the law against public defecation. Is that the only one, or are there other laws that we, in your view, should not enforce? I'm not saying we shouldn't enforce them, period, she said. If a frat guy gets too much to drink and decides to use my driveway as his bathroom, I've not only said I would get him ticketed, but I've made him come and clean it up. There's a different level of capacity involved when the homeless guy who's talking to himself is in my driveway. I go and talk to him and bring him something to eat and ask him if he has a place to stay and try and develop a relationship with him. I'm dealing with people defecating, not urinating, I said. I'm not sure it's my job to evaluate whether the person is mentally ill or just a drunk frat boy. I don't want to say that what they're doing isn't harmful, she said, but you have to have mens rea to be committing a crime. Mens rea is a legal term. It is Latin for guilty mind, and refers to a person's awareness that what he is doing is wrong and illegal. The standard is usually that a person knows or should know that what they are doing is illegal. The frat guy knows he should not be pooping in your driveway, she said. The guy who's psychotic may not know. In other words, for Meisner and the ACLU, the mentally ill are too impaired to be held accountable for breaking the law, but not impaired enough to justify the same kind of treatment we provide to other people suffering mental disabilities, such as dementia. Understanding this and the power of the ACLU in progressive cities and states, such as San Francisco and California, goes a long way toward understanding the addiction, untreated mental illness, and homelessness crisis. I told John Snook about my conversation with the ACLU. Progressives say there isn't enough treatment, but it's the only place they make that argument. He said, they never flagged the fact that it's because of their work shutting down the mental hospitals in the past, and that California would have the Medicaid waiver if it were not worried about what the ACLU had to say. The ACLU's continuing political power to prevent psychiatric treatment of the seriously mentally ill upsets retired University of California San Francisco psychiatrist Dr. Robert Okun. Civil rights lawyers, he said, were more interested in people's civil rights than their lives. While the ACLU is powerful, there is a growing movement for reform comprising natural, if seemingly unlikely, allies. Psychiatrists, street doctors, police officers, and civil rights leaders. Relationships are emerging between doctors and police. And there is growing bipartisan support in both liberal and conservative states for getting the seriously mentally ill the care they need. Dr. Thomas Insel, Gavin Newsom's mental health advisor, said that New York provided better mental health services, and that doing so was enough to overcome ACLU opposition to greater use of involuntary care. In New York, they said, take your medicine, but we're also going to provide you with 18 different things that will give you a reason to take your medicine and a reason to care. Was opposition from the ACLU easier to overcome? I asked. Because New York had a proper system of care? Yeah, that's right, said Insel. Even so, he said, the radical anti-psychiatry movement remained opposed to expanding conservatorships. Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg has put together these forums on conservancy and how to change current regulations. I've sat in on one or two of them. They're pretty frustrating, frankly. It's been hard to find common ground. Insel felt that federal reforms would eliminate the requirement that California apply for the special exemption to receive Medicaid money to treat the mentally ill, and noted that 2021 federal stimulus was pumping a ton of money into this. The problem, said Insel, is that the people who are running this in the federal government don't even know who to deal with in California because there is no State Department of Mental Health the way you have in other states. In their reflective moments, I found that many progressives agreed that more involuntary treatment is needed. I asked progressive Berkeley homelessness advocate Buna Chima, whose son was mentally ill and committed suicide, if we used conservatorships enough. No, we don't, she said. Somebody comes in who has been walking naked in the streets and is manic, and you take them in and then you let them out 2 days later. Come on, they haven't even been stabilized. Said homeless housing provider Louis Chiquin. Last year we went to a concert and on the way back, this woman's on the BART train platform and is just out of it. I mean, it's hard to imagine someone more out of it. She had a crack pipe. She was most likely seriously mentally ill and self-medicating. I want to protect people's rights, but how are we protecting this woman's rights when she's 5 feet from falling on the tracks and being run over? Continued Chiquin. I could call someone, and they'd tell me they can't do anything about it because she's not literally a threat to herself or someone else. We're careful about saying this publicly because we want to stay allied with the people we serve. But there's a truth in the need to remove from some people the right to do whatever the hell they want when they have absolutely no control of themselves. Insel said he felt the people of California would come around once they understood the problem. I started from a civil libertarian perspective, he said. But at the end of the day, I don't want to see people die with their rights on. That's not the solution. Susan Partovi expressed hopes for a long-acting antipsychosis medicine. I've gotten 4 people on injectable once-a-month antipsychotic treatment, she said. People have proven that they can't take medications on their own, but they're willing to take the injection. It's night and day. Now they're able to think clearly and accept resources. One of them refused to be with a roommate, but now she's got a place to stay with a roommate. She's off the streets, going to homeless health care for her drug treatment program. I'm almost thinking now that for some people, it's not housing first, it's medication first.